Yeah, I don't know, man. You ever just feel like life is just catapulting towards some greater purpose?
Cats with bloated ego. We are the only DJ crazy enough to tattoo Jackie Brown on his ass.
This is Michael Mann, and I ride with
Extended Clip.
Welcome to Extended Clip. It is episode 285. I'm one of your hosts, Eddie Averill.
I'm Malcolm Baum.
And JT, he's very sick with a case of flaking on the podcast, so wish him well. He is in the hospital with it's ravaging him, flakeitis right now. So I really hope he gets better. Joining us today on the podcast, he is a New York filmmaker extraordinaire. You may know his films such as Job's World, Happy Life. It is Michael Bylandek. What's up, Mike? How you doing?
What's up? Thanks for having me.
Glad to see a fellow brother in yellow Gatorade on the podcast today. See, I got two beverages on deck. Mike's got his Gatorade. Malcolm's got his Celsius. I feel very connected to the two.
Wait, is it zero or grown man Gatorade?
No, I'm not going Gatorade heavy today. I just have to go with the zero. Yeah. You know, I walked 8 blocks to the Giant just to get my sugar-free sodas.
Nice. I saw this square last night, and there's like a giant billboard for Gatorade water.
Nice.
I guess it's like the new thing. Some like a electrolyte infused water, but I haven't seen it in the wild yet. I just saw the hype.
Well, they also have the Gator Light now, which is like Pedialyte Gatorade. So it's like if you're too hungover for Gatorade and you really need the real shit, you got to hit the Gator Light. And then because of that, I've been seeing these other brands do their like bootleg Pedialyte drinks, and there's a fucking Barstool Pedialyte. It's like a little blue bottle, and it has the Barstool logo on it, and it's just like clearly marketed at like a hangover kind of cure, but it's pretty sick. I did drink one, and it tastes better than like most Gatorade flavors, to be honest.
Do you know this is a group called the Moist Boys? They were like a rap rock 90s group. Their song's called Carjack. I saw them in concert one time, and it was like the most fucked up I've ever seen someone on stage, and he came out drinking a giant Gatorade, and you know, it's you're in crisis mode. You have to bring Gatorade on stage with you. But
So the reason for having Mike on the pod today is twofold. Firstly, because this is a movie podcast and we like to just talk about movies, Mike's joining us to talk about Light Sleeper by Paul Schrader, one of the bigger, if not at this point, the biggest Paul Schrader blind spot for me. You know me, always saving room for dessert with a lot of these directors, you know, holding off one of the classics. And I think it was Mishima and Light Sleeper I tried to wait as long as I possibly could for. Mishima immediately became my favorite Schrader. Light Sleeper is incredibly sick too. So Mike, thank you for bringing on the pod. So you're coming on also because your film Job's World is getting a new Blu-ray released by Vinegar Syndrome, and everyone can go buy that online on the Vinegar Syndrome site. But you told me that Light Sleeper was a big one for you, influencing Job's World. So what is it about this film that made you want to bring it to the pod?
Yeah, you know, it was just the one movie that was sort of always in the room. It was the one that, from the writing to the shooting, it was always sort of there on a lot of levels, on a macro level, micro level. I hadn't watched it in a few years, and I just watched it the other day now, but through the lens of how it influenced it. And I was like shocked by how much we liberally borrowed from it. From the whole premise to the specific details within scenes. For a second, I was weirded out, but then I was like, this movie, Light Sleeper, borrows beyond liberally from Pickpocket, from his own work, to millions of references to other things. And it felt like it was sort of in the tradition to do that. And even he was saying in one of the scenes in Light Sleeper, they're at the drug dealer's house, and they're Scorpio Rising is on the TV. And he's like, shit. Well, he's like, well, I was friends with Kenneth Anger at the time, so I had to ask him for permission to use this clip. But he was like, I don't know if I really need to, because he borrowed so much from other stuff in that.
Yeah, right.
So, I feel okay.
that's not a movie you want to fill out a form for, really.
Yeah, so, you know, so, like, on a large scale, it's, you know, it's a movie about, they're both movies about drug, middle-aged drug dealers who sort of have these pasts that didn't go right and have these ambitions for the future that, you know, aren't going to work. And also it takes place at night within a confined part of Manhattan. And, you know, but also with these voiceovers that show another sort of side of the character. And they're both sort of dialogue heavy scenario to scenario of someone using a form of transportation to get from each place to the other. And just sort of about this, like, these characters that are almost empty sort of vessels. And, yeah, it, but then there's the stuff like the having the female drug boss with the gay sidekick and the Thai, always trying to push Thai food on him. I was like, that's not even an influence. That's just a direct.
Well, at least you're brave enough to admit who you stole from. I was reading Hawks on Hawks earlier, like a couple weeks ago. And he was saying, like, the only problem he has with Bogdanovich is that he let people know who he stole from. He's like, you got to keep that shit more low key. You can't, like, let people know who you steal from. And I thought that was very funny because you clearly, you know, wear the influences on your sleeve and whatnot.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I was watching this movie called Club Life last week. It's from the 80s. And there's this, it all takes place in this nightclub. And this part with this guy makes someone do a line of coke. And he says, here, take a hit of this. Be somebody. And then it's a great line. I was like sitting next to Sean, like, damn, that's a great line. We love people less. And then someone's like, oh, that line is in Kill Bill 2, you know? And I was looking this up and no one was even written about it or anything. It's just funny. These, like, you know, when, and even when there's a line you like, just fucking doing it. And then Schrader was saying he uses the same, yeah, he repeats like last lines all the time in his own movies. And
stuff. I mean, he repeats the endings of the movie all the time. You know, like, when he figured out that he could fuse Pickpocket with Diary of a Country Priest and, like, create a genre out of that, he was just like, all right, I'm settled for the next 50 years. And that's why we love him. Malcolm, you'd seen Light Sleeper before, right?
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny with me looking at Job's World, I was like, oh, yeah, obviously, you know, Light Sleeper's influence, you know, by the movie. I didn't, you know, it wasn't explicitly told to me that was the thing, you know what I mean? I was like, oh, wow, it's like these movies are really similar. But Light Sleeper, it's one of the Schrader movies I've actually seen the most, funny enough. And it is just one of my favorites because it just has just a real, like, raw sense of emotionality to it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I just really appreciate it. I just feel like there's a lot of great performances here, and it's, you know, just kind of a gentle look at a harsh world, but, you know, it still keeps the griminess, you know, you still see all the trash on the streets and whatnot, you know? So, I feel like this movie just has a specific mood, and, you know, it's funny because it is, like, it is similar to a lot of Schrader movies, but, like, I don't know, this one just seems to, maybe it's the Christian rock. I think it's the Christian rock that gives it edge for me that, I don't know. It's it just emotionally hits a little bit different than the rest of Schrader's filmography for me.
I think he was saying it's like his favorite, at a point he was saying it was his favorite of his movies. He might like First Reformed more, but yeah, definitely. It is a blind spot for so many people, but I think for the people that have seen it, is, yeah, usually one of their favorites.
Yeah, I think the raw emotionality is probably the biggest thing that you bring up here. I mean, I feel like you don't want to go full on and say he's a sentimental director in any of his movies, but the slight hints towards sentimentalism in this movie really do a lot of heavy lifting for me. And that, like, also in combination with, yeah, the cinematography and score and whatnot, like, he's in a very different mood as far as the mood pieces go, where You look like American Gigolo, and I feel like the synth score for that is almost like dialectic because the rest of the movie is so fucking bleak and dour, and Richard Gere being sad about having to fuck so much, and like then that synth music comes in and it's like, oh, that's what the movie's quote unquote supposed to be by the marketing and whatnot. Where this movie, I feel like the actual soul of it is in like those lyrical passages of him just like driving through the city at night with the music cranking. And I love that about it. Like Schrader actually allowed himself. It's funny, we're doing another episode on Four Nights of a Dreamer later tonight. And that's one where Bresson is like really letting himself vibe like crazy. And it kind of reminds me of Schrader in this one, just like giving into just the slightest bit of more mainstream tendencies and still 1,000% through his own sensibilities. So yeah, it's just like such a fun vibe.
Talking about the music, it's like, it really, from the very first second of the movie, you see the streets, the cobblestones in the rain, you hear that synth music, and you either love it or you don't. And if you don't like it, you're not going to like it. And if you love it, you're like with it. But the score is just such an essential part of it. And like the more I was reading about the making of it, it really is quite a tale. How, you know, it was originally written for... He wrote the movie and conceived of it with these five Bob Dylan songs in particular.
Oh, really? I did not know that because I love the Schrader Dylan late 80s crossover with everything with Empire Burlesque and the Tight Connection video. I didn't know that. Let me drop some knowledge.
Yeah, Tight Connection. Yeah. That was the video he did for Dylan. So he thought, since he did that video, I'm boys with Dylan, he'll let me do whatever I want. And he conceived of this with five songs in mind. They were from Empire Burlesque, Mercy, and Shot of Love. And the main song he wanted, the whole movie was supposed to revolve around, was There's Something Burning, Something's Burning Baby from Empire Burlesque. And if you listen to that and World's on Fire, it's astonishing, the similarities. But so he wrote the movie. He proposes this to Dylan, and Dylan says, no, I'm not going to give you these five songs under any circumstance. And he's like, well, but I wrote the movie for these five songs. He's like, well, the good news is I'll give you five songs for free. And offers him five songs that have nothing to do with it. And he's like, I'll make a whole new version of Summertime by Gershwin free. And he's like, I don't want that.
Oh, my God. That's so perfect for late period Dylan, too, just wanting to do old songbook shit.
Yeah. So they get Michael Biehn, you know, the Christian rocker, and they just sort of do their version of it. And I think it works out really well because they're able to do it exactly to their liking. And he always jokes, or not jokes, but says that it's like a additional form of narration in the movie, and, you know, enhances, you know, the psychology and the plot along with the, you know, ambience and stuff. So I really love it. The like saxophone and synth is just and there's parts where you'll see like the car driving, and then there's no lyrics. You just hear him breathing. Like, it's so sleazy. And the score is just like, it's kind of like how Paul Schrader talks. You hear these like breath like all the time. It's cool. Yeah. It's really,
I mean, the crossing paths are very divergent there between Schrader and Dylan, as he's using the music from, this would be 7 years after Dylan converted to Christianity. And then Schrader being a lapsed, what did he grow up?
Not Calvinist.
Calvinist. Yeah, I always forget that. Which
rare
one?
Strain of Christianity.
Yeah, which one of those rare strains he was smoking on. Yeah. But yeah,
no, so it's funny because whenever he starts talking about that, I just tune out.
Yeah.
I can't follow this shit. And it's great because there's this scene with David Spade.
Yeah.
Who's credited as the theological cokehead.
One of the great character names.
Rambling about God. And Schrader was saying that that character is based on him. And he's like, every time I do coke, I just start talking about God. And like, I love the way that scene works, where Willem Dafoe's pretending like he's listening, but then there's voiceover where he's like talking about basically other shit. And like, that's kind of how I feel when I hear these like esoteric branches of theology.
Yeah.
And that's a real, and that's another type of comedy that I really like in movies in general, is the one person blabbering, another person not really listening to it, and then a voiceover is something different to that. But that scene's great. And they're saying that he originally wanted Dana Carvey, I guess, to be the cokehead. And then he didn't want to do it. And then Lorne Michaels said he should try David Spade.
Damn. And now those two have a podcast together. Podcasting will always connect people. Yeah. It always brings people together. Yeah, I mean, Schrader's religious background, like, informing, obviously, like, his admiration for people like Dreyer and, like, the aestheticism of it and everything is, like, key to his work. But as you said, it's easy to zone that, like, totally tune that out as well, because, like, that doesn't align with my interests. Like, I'm not a religious person at all. And you don't have to be to get that much out of Schrader, you know?
Yeah, I think with him too, it's like with Calvinism is like particularly like strange and just kind of, yeah. I think it like you're immediately fucked up if you're a Calvinist. So it's kind of like you don't even need to know the religious specifics. You just need to know how it, you don't even need to know how, but you just know that it like informs like, you know, how he tortures himself and how like every Schrader protagonist kind of, you know, deals with that is kind of like Calvinist is just weird. It's like they say like, from the jump that like you're going to go to heaven or not. So like,
yeah,
there's just people who are like, I'm going to go to hell when I die because I wasn't chosen. It's just like, how the fuck do you live with that? I don't know.
I love the classic story of, you know, Fiona Apple, where she said she like stopped doing coke after spending a night with Paul Thomas Anderson and Quentin Tarantino in their theater.
Yeah.
Like just being that someone in the zone really going in on their interests and it not hitting right for you is really like,
yeah,
something I'm trying to imagine, like being in the room with like 80s theological mode Schrader, like, you know, day four of,
just like the clash of the titans of the,
yeah, whatever
clash of the titans, him and Abel Ferrara and like all the other like lapsed Catholic and Christian filmmakers just drugged out in the 80s.
Well, I mean, you know, I got a lot about that I could get into. Abel really wanted to do a video on Empire Burlesque, and
oh, really?
I think it might have been a tight connection to my heart. But he has some great stories about that period and when that album came out. And
wow, so I feel like there's someone whose screen name I think it says Zane, but it looks like there's someone in the Zoom.
Hello.
Gotta be the man himself.
Oh, that's the Zane from the movie Job's World. What's up, Zane?
Hello.
Hello, man. I just caught up on your recent video. It was pretty sick, man. I hope you've been catching some fish lately.
Yeah, actually, I'm in a place right now that is very fishy. On Walter Street.
Yeah.
It's raining in New York, so the feeling here is very blue.
Mm-hmm.
Zan, I'm really happy that you're in a place that's blue, but you know, we were just talking about light sleeper hair, and I got a call from Dr. Jackman recently. You know,
you're speaking really to Dr. Hold
you.
On, you're
he said I'm being an enabler Jackman? By working with you, and you know, maybe we shouldn't be doing this type
you're
of stuff.
You're being an enabler when Dr. Jackman exploited and tricked me?
No, it's not an enabler, but you know, you just really need to probably check back in with him. And you know, I'm not sure if we should be working together or talking on podcasts until, you know, you do some personal work on yourself.
Well, right now I'm mostly listening to the Sea Glass Carousel out here on Walter Street. It's an aquatic themed ride. It's very big fish swimming up and down.
Nice.
And you can find it if you're little or big, either one. And there's sleepy swimming music and some of the more music across. There's even more music that's right across. Sorry, I'm sleepy, but there's more music that's right across the street. There was a happy chubby man blasting Billy Joel on Q104.3 on FM in his car. A song called My Life, based on saying all good things that this is my life.
As a New Yorker, really do you just like get enough Billy Joel at a certain point?
Not when it's my life, because it's a little like you wrote it for me.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, Zen, you know, I'm glad to hear that the Aquatic Museum is great. You got Billy Joel, but you know, we're talking about movies here. So, since you're here, I know you love Disney. I know you love Lumiere, the candle.
Yeah.
But Yeah, have you seen any good new Disney movies or old Disney movies or, you know, what?
Have I been watching Disney movies? Of course, yeah. I've been watching Disney movies. I'm an expert on everything that has everything to do with Disney. I don't have, there's now a computer show. There's all these computer shows now that Disney has, yeah. But I don't have, except sometimes for Wi-Fi at my grandmother's house, I can't look at the computer. So I am just really listening to the radio. What station are you guys on, by the way, right now?
In Jersey, I think it might come through on WFMU right now. If you're in New York, you could get it. But like, you know, I heard you telling some Jersey stories in one of your stand-up sets once. By the way, are you doing stand-up anymore? Because like that didn't seem present in your last update.
No, Dr. Jackman set me up at Listen First, which is the club and the night that I was working. It was just like a good extra muscle for me to work on while I was working with him.
Yeah.
But that's no longer, I had a falling out with Listen First and with Dr. Jackman and then with Listen First, who say you can't come around here no more. And then the night went away. So that has everything to do with that they were in the wrong. It wasn't me. It was Listen First. That was in the wrong. You gotta
go back to Dr. Jackman.
The night went away. I think you really do need to go back to your doctor. You know? He's saying the night went away. I don't know what that means.
There was a night that I performed at called Listen First, and they no longer do it. So they were, and I had a falling out with them.
Yeah.
Because they said I can't. I have to talk to Dr. Jackman if I'm gonna behave and do it good.
Before you go, Zane, have you ever seen a movie by Paul Schrader? You ever see like Affliction? You ever heard of that one?
No, but I was watching a bad movie called The Minions of these little guys hopping around. It's actually within the Disney universe, but they don't know about, it's like they don't even know the history of Disney like I do. They don't know about Toy Story and the aliens jumping up and down, excited for the claw. They don't know anything about a lot of the history of Disney and Pixar. They don't even know. So they're just making these movies. It's very much a motif of Disney, these little hyper men screaming and jumping and excited. That's just something that happens, multiple little men jumping and excited in Disney movies and Pixar movies. So they don't even know that, the Minions.
Damn.
Wow. Those Minions are dumb.
Yeah, Minions are critique. Very dumb. You know?
Dumb as fucking shit.
A lot of people are saying they're about Killers of the Flower Moon, too. What was that?
I don't know what Killers of the... I don't know. No Killers. I'm getting called to dinner.
All right, man. Enjoy your dinner. Enjoy your doctor. All right. I will talk to you later, Zane.
All right. We'll see you.
Bye. Catch Goodbye.
Up. Well, you know, we were supposed to talk about Job's World later on in the podcast, but I think it's in the nature of the film and that particular character from the film. And in the nature of Light Sleeper for a drug addict to make their presence known.
There's a couple of great. Yeah, and those are some of my favorite parts of Light Sleeper are the sort of manic, out of control sort of guys. And it was really interesting that the Eddie character in it, the sort of guy with the messy apartment who's been up for days, that you know really is probably the most on the edge of the people they see. I did not know anything about that actor who plays him. He, Paul Jabara, and that guy, he wrote It's Raining Men.
What?
Yeah.
Damn.
Like the actor who plays the cokehead. And that was like an old party friend of Paul Schrader's. And he wrote It's Raining Men. And then he died of AIDS right after the movie came out. So.
Jesus Christ.
That scene, the two scenes with him, was nice, and that brought a sort of a different energy.
That's insane. I feel like this movie is bringing us into a lot of corners of music that I didn't expect it to, between Bob Dylan and It's Raining Men.
Yeah. There was a bunch of AIDS sort of stuff that was kind of interesting, too, and I was reading up on it a bit, because he was saying, so it's based on three real people, the movie. And one of them was a drug dealer that he knew in the past. And he caught up with them when he wanted to make this movie again. And so it really was a lady who ran the operation and then two guys that worked for her. Except both of the guys were gay. And she was more plus size. And The guy who Latour is based on also died of AIDS in real life. And then the other thing that was crazy, so the woman that it was based on, he was claiming she died in a lewds deal gone wrong or something.
Damn.
And that instead of doing a cosmetics line, she was trying to start a plus size clothing line. Damn. And that was sort of the pipe dream that was always being carrot dangled when they would hang out.
And I know Susan Sarandon is like way sexy and like that's going to put butts in seats, but like that would make it such a funnier movie if the drug dealing lady was just like pursuing plus size side hustles like throughout it.
Yeah. And then he was saying he like approached her. He said, "Hey, is it okay if I use elements of your real story in this movie I'm making?" And she's like, "Well, let me get back to you," and had to vet Schrader through Bertolucci, who I guess she was tight with. And he's like, "Yeah, this guy's cool." And yeah, she got the green light from the elite party animal entertainers, you know.
That's so insane. I like American Gigolo as a comparison to this too, because I don't know, just being able to shoot at night in New York obviously seems to be a big influence on you among other filmmakers. And I don't know what it is about that, but like the difference between the like very detached driving around during the day of American Gigolo and just like roaming the streets of New York feeling 1,000 times more intimate right away, you know, like when George T. Scott's walking down the Sunset Strip in Hardcore, it's like he really does feel so removed from everything still, despite him plunging himself into the depths or whatever. Whereas the New York stuff, I don't know why the immediacy is so crazy, especially for Schrader, who like keeps it so distanced and calm for so much of his stuff.
Well, the thing that's crazy is he doesn't have that many new. This is like his only New York movie.
I thought he had two. I have one.
The Highline one.
I'm just thinking of Taxi Driver.
Actually, I know. Yeah.
I guess I'm thinking of this and Taxi Driver.
I wish you'd do more. Yeah. And his new, and the Highline one's a masterpiece too. But no, it's funny. It was like when I was walking home last night, it was raining. I was on Bond Street. I was telling people I was going to do this. And I like took a photo of like the street. And I was like, yeah, this is like the opening of a Late Sleeper. You know, I've been torturing everyone. Being like, oh, this is where the payphone is, and the when he snitches on a guy, this is that. I mean, I walked around a couple nights ago, and it was like, you know, I walked by the hotel that they have sex in, I walked by the hotel where it ends, walked by the, and you know, it's also sort of like Joe's World and or the stuff that I like, where it is contained into almost a walking distance type area.
Yeah,
there's something fun about it. So 92, or I guess it's shot 91, comes out 92. It's just such a weird period, because it's like you're not in that like full, it's like the yuppie thing is kind of changing. It's not like the big 80s version. It's about to become like a Sex and the City kind of thing. And it's not, they're not showing the bombed out buildings like you see in every 80s movie. Weird yuppie-ish kind of professional.
It does feel in between. I mean, I'm obviously far from a New York expert. I've fucking been there 5 times in my life, but just from movies, like, you know, something like the 80s New York in, I don't know, Alphabet City or something like that. And then the cleaner versions you see in the 90s. This does feel very removed from either of those sides. Like, it is like a weirdly, I don't know, between the garbage strike going on in the background, that being such a great backdrop for the film, it just does feel like a very unique movie that I haven't seen other versions of. Like,
yeah,
I feel quite like that.
No, that guy, Keith McNally, the restaurateur, he made a movie in the early in 1990 called End of the Night. And I just saw it the other week, and it was sort of like the same shot in the same area, the same world, as sort of like a guy going to like nightclubs. And it really like, it's a weird thing. It did not make me want, neither of these movies make me want to hop in the time machine and be like, you know, I just want to be in the middle of Late Sleeper. You know, it's, you know, I don't like, in the End of the Night, it's all that sort of Jim Jarmusch, like Lounge Lizard type mixology kind of vibe mixed with this like house. And there's so much house music, like the one bar they go to, it's like something, and same with that. And it's just, you know, I love a lot of periods, but this isn't necessarily my first stop.
Yeah. From like an outsider's view, it seems like maybe just kind of like an honest depiction of New York, right?
Yeah, 100%,
like you think of like King of New York, right? That comes out like around the same time. And obviously, I think it's, I don't know the geography so well, but I think they're playing with different locations there. But it's like, that's trying to show like a more grimier side of New York, obviously. And this one, yeah, it just kind of feels honest. I guess it is kind of like, maybe it's like a transitional period, you know what I mean? Because like,
so
I
what neighborhoods like, would this be taking place in for Light Sleeper?
It's mostly in like sort of Meatpacking District, Chelsea, West Village, and then there's Midtown, a couple of hotels, and then gets the gun on in like Harlem.
Okay.
But no, it's interesting. The clothing is really interesting too. It's all Armani. Every single person in this movie is completely like Armani'd out. And it's weird because everyone just looks really professional and really expensive. Yeah. You know, it's like, it's really gives it another element to that sort of yuppie upper class thing. And it really, like, the gangsters look so bizarre with these like suit, like blazer sleeves rolled up and stuff. I'm like, what type of gangster is this? But because I guess American Gigolo made Armani famous, because it's like they do the tailoring scene and those suits on the bed, and that really like blew it up. And then this is sort of like a come down of some 80s yuppie thing, and it's just a unique style, and like that T-Sky is really something.
And like, speaking of the professional style of weird looking gangsters, I mean, Defoe in the last scene when he gets the gun, like, doesn't know anything about what to do with it, like, even remotely. Like, he's just so lost asking for instructions, and I love that about it. Like, it just feels like he's such a high-end drug dealer, but you just kind of pull a few strings, tear a few things away. It's like, oh, he's barely hanging on at all. Like, how did he even get to this kind of like high-class position? He's, you know, clearly fucked himself over and the people around him so many times in his life through addiction and just being a tortured person, like every Schrader protagonist. And also,
he speaking of... He can't do shit. He's like, claims he's going to get the music recording. You know he has no idea how to do
this. Also, compared to the other Schrader tortured protagonists, I kind of like him the most in terms of like what mindset he's in and what he takes solace in, because unlike the more religious ones or whatever, he's just like, he has a lucky jacket and he talks about people's vibes and stuff like that. And it's just like, I just kind of like that honest depiction of what like drugged out people usually are. They're not going to be the people writing the profound diaries. They're going to be a guy like him making a list of people with left-handed people, and what's the other thing on the list?
Oh, eyes that don't match or something.
Eyes that don't match. Yeah.
No, he was saying that one of the real drug dealers had a journal, and that was he took real. That was completely real. Yeah,
that's so sick.
The one crazy clothing choice was the Sam Rockwell. I don't know if you clocked this.
Yeah.
And like Defoe's like, I love your jacket. That's a sick jacket. He's got this like leather and black or red and black leather jacket. And you don't really see it that well. And then he turns around and you see it's a fucking Bundeswehr thing. It's got it's the yay vultures, you know, fucking thing. It's got the giant vulture. It's got the bird on it. It just says Germany in giant letters. And Defoe's just like, I love your jacket, man. It's like sick. Pretty cool.
It is an insane I mean, like, that's the kind of thing where you clock the jacket before you even clock that it's Sam Rockwell, you know.
Yeah, the total drug dealer thing too, where it's like, y'all just give you this jacket, dude.
Yeah. But it's so much more like poppy than you would see in other like more raggedy drug dealer kind of stuff. Like, I don't know, it's a mix of a 80s movie drug dealer jacket and like the 8-ball jacket Putty gets on Seinfeld. Yeah. You know,
One of the greatest, one of my favorite plot points in it is when he gets really stressed out at the end. When he starts becoming a cologne freak and he like has his shirt off, and he's like lathering himself in cologne and he like licks his finger with the cologne. And then, so he's with Jane Addams and she's like, what's that smell? And he's like, oh, you know, it's my cologne. It's a cheap air. It's an airplane cologne. And then later when he's with Susan Sarandon, he makes her stop the car and he gets the gun and puts more cologne on. And then she has the greatest line ever. She's like, what took you so long? Were you douching up there or something? And then she's like, what's that smell? Like, what is that cologne? He's like, oh, it's my cologne. She's like, it's like airplane cologne. And I was like, what the fuck is airplane Klum.
Yeah, it's like the little travel testers, right?
Yeah, I guess.
I guess, yeah. That's just looking up. Yeah, it's like those like weird old like first class like dop kit toiletry container things with like a razor, like cologne. That was like for a second, I was just like, what the fuck is like
airplane cologne? Yeah,
airplane cologne. But yeah, I totally forgot about those. You don't see those things anymore. Those toiletry kits.
So after you know, a shootout ending, you get the classic ending for Schrader, the pickpocket ending once again. And I do like the romanticism coming out full force here with what appears to be a freeze frame at first, and then you realize, oh no, he's just like hanging on Defoe's embrace of Sarandon, and like you see his eyes kind of flutter toward the end too, and you're like, oh my god, what a great little intimate moment there. And yeah, I feel like that's almost like the definitive difference between this and all the other Bresson riffs that he's done is the tenderness in it, because I don't know, a lot of people said they felt that in the Tiffany Haddish relationship in The Card Counter, but I felt like those were like two different stories, kind of the crux of the story and then that part. And I like The Card Counter a lot too, but mm-hmm. I just think that kind of pushes it over the edge for me, and sitting on it for a day and talking it out, you know, really helps. So overall, wrapping up, I'm going to go 4 bullets on this one at 5. Malcolm, what about you?
Yeah, I'm going to go 4 bullets as well. I mean, he does the pickpocket ending a lot, although it seems like this time, I don't know, it hits a little bit more perfectly, you know, with, you know, him ending up in jail like that. And I don't know, there's just like a lot of, like, I love him and Sarandon's relationship, and kind of, you know, he's kind of, especially when he's by himself or like trying to reconcile with his ex-girlfriend, he kind of seems like a little bit defeated, but he does a good job of kind of like lightening himself up sometimes, you know, like I think of like that lunch scene or whatever. And I love like kind of his drug dealer spirituality with like the psychic. Like the psychic scenes are some of my favorite parts of the movie. And you know, you're saying that Schrader was inspired by like actual people he knew. It kind of makes sense given like the nature of the movie and how like, you know, characters are kind of given their own little spot to shine and whatnot. And you know, their various relationships are feel kind of like they have a real depth to them, like kind of like the Jane Addams character, and the connection he has with her is just, I don't know, it just seems so lived in, where, you know, most movies wouldn't even kind of bother with that type of relationship. So, yeah, I really like this movie.
Mike, any final thoughts on this one as it pertains to your work and just as a film on its own, and a rating on a scale of 1 to 5 bullets?
Yeah, man, 5 bullets. As many bullets as we got, just keep fucking burning them for Light Sleeper. That's the hard shit. Yeah, you point it at the bad guy, pull the trigger, and the bad guy falls down.
Unload the clip.
Great line.
Yeah, that's good. It's just a great one, man. I love the whole structure. I love the genre. I love the nighttime New York going around meeting a bunch of freaks, and it's a genre that I love to work in. I hope it's a genre that continues, man. There's no reason not to just keep these freaks going around all night meeting Absolutely. A bunch of psychos, doing some dumb shit, having some pipe dreams, and with some sick music. Like, what else do you want? It's yeah, love it.
Well said. We'll be right back on Extended Clip.
I feel my life turning. All it needed was a direction. You drift from day to day, years go by. Then a change comes. I am able to change. I can be a good person. What a strange thing to happen halfway through your life. What luck.
So there's kind of like, you had to face an obstacle to get your package. There was kind of like a gnarling dog about to attack, and you kind of had to time it out perfectly. And it's very like Indiana Jones-ish.
I was just going to say, it's a classic stereotypical mailman dog, you know, rivalries, tales old as time, you know.
True. People never considered the male receiver, you know?
That's true. That is the part of the equation people always leave out. We're back on Extended Clip. Me, Malcolm, Mike Balandek. We're not doing Malcolm in the Middle this week, though, because we have a guest that's more interesting than Malcolm. Sorry, Malcolm. You're interesting. It's just, you know, we want to talk to our guest about
his... Well, the subject's not about me, so
no, you don't I know. Need to and pit when, me against... And when you direct a movie, we'll do a full episode just, like, interviewing you weirdly. I don't know about that, actually, but... Mike, was this new Blu-ray, like, is it a long time coming since the production of the film, or 4 years after the movie, did they come to you with the idea of doing a special edition for it?
You know, it's something I always really wanted. You know, it's this thing where, to me, that's the end of the process, you know, is when you have a physical thing, even though that's not the way most people consume stuff anymore, yeah. You know, but to me, it's like just putting it out there in the ether is okay. But this is really something I wanted for a while. And it was not really, because we did Hellaware and Project Space came out through Vinegar Syndrome also. But This one was like on the fence. So, but weirdly, when the movie came out, I was like, dude, we need a fucking DVD of this, we need a Blu-ray of this. And it just wasn't going to happen. So I had this idea where I said, I want to make the world's first wearable movie. All right. And I got this jewelry. This guy named Danny McDonald. He's this great artist. He's like he's been like Winnie Biennial. He has a jewelry line called Mended Veil. He used to work at this place called... American Fine Arts. He's just a really eccentric artist who makes his art is all just like statues of the rock, like drinking his own pee, just like a real weirdo bohemian guy. And I worked with him, and we made this limited edition necklace that had a bunch, like a finger at the end of it, and these like rare jewels and like leather, like strap, and it's a sort of avant-garde necklace that had a USB of Joe's World. Nice. But it was expensive. Like, this is like, this guy's stuff is in Barney's and stuff. It's a very high end quality. So I put this fucking thing out. No one in this sort of indie film world was going to spend a lot of money to get this like avant garde finger. People in the like art world, what the fuck's Job's World? And it really, I thought this was going to take off and be like, really our crowning achievement is that we're going to start making wearable movies. I had another idea. I was going to do a shirt where you could fit the DVD in it. And it was going to be a anti-bullying thing where you don't get made fun of for walking around with Blu-rays. And it was a dud. It was artistically a major success. Commercially, didn't hit. And I got it in this, like, our friend Judy Rosen's boutique in Soho. And, I think in the future, Real Heads will really come to...
The shirt version reminds me of in the mid 2000s there was a trend of like backpacks, especially, and I saw sweatshirts that had like MP3 player holders, like back before it was even like people listening to music on their phones mainly. It was like, put your MP3 player here and then run your cable through it for your backpack, you know, wearable MP3 player, really.
Definitely. There's a history of wearable tech, and or even like those Huddy Flakes jeans that had like the condom pocket or something. But my friend Steven Gerwitz and I were at a bar last year, and he had just got like a Lost Highway Blu-ray from Criterion or something, and some guy just started roasting us at the fucking bar. It's like, nice Blu-ray, what are you gonna do, like go home and watch your like Blu-ray together and stuff? And we're like, fuck, man. It was so shocking that we were like actually just like cracking up. And, like,
that's like, sick. Fuck,
man. You gotta find a discreet way to walk around with Blu-rays so you don't get like...
I better stay out of New York, dude. I got like Blu-rays in the tote bag like 80% of the time. I'm gonna get roasted.
Yeah, tote bag, that's like an open, you're like, that's just, you know, wearing it right in the fucking open.
I keep having nightmares where I spill all my Blu-rays out of my tote bag and everyone laughs at me, you know. It's gonna happen.
They don't even steal them from you, they just like stop at you.
Oh, you got that on sale, you
bitch. Nice pickpocket Blu-ray Fucking loser. Like, yeah.
Still keeping that Spanglish DVD around. Didn't wanna
nice punch drunk love, you know, fucking like out of print, whatever the fuck,
yeah,
press kit. Yeah. But, so this thing didn't, so I artistically was pleased with the finger, but I was like, guys, we need a real release here.
Yeah.
And finally, and people are asking for it. I, you know, people are like, hey, we want to see this thing. So finally we got the green light. And the thing that was with Hellware and Hellware, we got the craziest one, because that the original DVD had the I'll Cut Your Dick Off 7-inch with it, which was the ultimate no one asked for edition. But that's why Factory 25 is so sick, is they're willing to press a fucking record with it. But but those ones were very rushed. There was like a very hard deadline, and especially Project Space, even though I really loved the disc, it was like we had to hand in all materials when it came out. So this, we had a couple months to work on this one, so I feel like I'm happy with this one. This one we really got to do it the way we wanted.
I mean, this is like a classic special edition with bonus features and everything. Like I was very pleased for the to be watching that like walkthrough of all the locations, and then you see Martin Rev walk by, and it's like I hate people doing like the oh man, only in New York kind of thing, but it's like, what the fuck, man? Martin Rev's just walking by it, you know, the locations you shoot at all the time.
It's
like
crazy. It's he really crazy. Is one of the last true
legends.
And like, it's so funny because when we were shooting the scene in Joe's World at night, when he started blading around, Martin Rev walked by us on that same street, and we're shooting this making of, and he like keeps walking by. So yeah, that was pretty crazy. But yeah, I have this problem where when I get a Blu-ray, I watch the special features first. I'm like,
yeah,
excited. And that's inevitably someone just in a talking head in front of their bookshelf, you know, which is cool stuff in it usually, but I want to do something that's like outside or something, or moving around, you know, do something where it's not going to be just something that would be a YouTube video necessarily.
Exactly. I think the art of the bonus feature is dead, and even the people who that's supposed to be their job suck at it. Like Criterion doesn't even do supplements anymore. It's like barely anything on those new discs. But I'm not going to talk too much crap. You know, I don't want to jinx my opportunity set by Criterion spotlight.
I worked on a couple of Abel's. I produced the one on the Addiction that he did. Either something shadow, whatever, something on the vampire.
Oh, like 20 years later one. That was sick.
And that was cool. That was like we went to Christopher Walken's house. We did all this stuff. We found, you know, it's great when they involve the director and get to make something that's like, you know, and then we showed the fucking thing at MoMA, you know, the fucking bonus feature. You know, it was sick. And then I worked a little bit on I produced his movie Mulberry Street, and that was a bonus feature on the Driller Killer DVD, which is like, so I was kind of thinking of those a little bit when we're working on them, because just nice to see some shit where you're in the streets walking around.
We did Mulberry Street on the podcast like years ago. Back when I was living in North Hollywood with JT. And David was on that episode. That one's awesome. I mean, the fucking the Modine the Segway cameo is just like one of the wildest things.
That was totally random too. It's really because I worked with him on Chelsea on the Rocks. I was his assistant.
How did you become just like his assistant?
I got a job as a PA.
Yeah.
Chelsea on the Rocks, and then we just, it's a very long story, I'm not going to get into it, but we became tight on the set of that, and I kept working with him after it. So, but he lived in the Chelsea Hotel through the whole production of it, through post-production, and then afterwards, it's like, all right, well, the producers were paying for it, now you got to move out of here. So he moved from Chelsea to Little Italy, and the guy Frankie C was, it's like his old friend, his manager at the time, and also owned a bunch of restaurants in Little Italy. So he said, yeah, just come, I'll get you an apartment on Mulberry Street. So he moves in there, and Abel had like a tab, lived there. This guy handled a lot of the details, and he was trying to make a couple bigger movies, and they were sort of in limbo. So he was like, well, let's just start shooting something. You know, since we're here, we have access. and we didn't even really know what it was going to be. At first, maybe it was going to be a series, a something, or whatever, you know. And it was, you know, we just shot for like, I don't know, 4 days or something. And it was, and they gave us an office in above the restaurant. I don't think you really see it in the movie. It was just like a lazy, with this tiny cubicle with a lazy boy, a bathroom, one TV that just played sports 24/7. That was the feed to the bar. And then you had to go to the restaurant's office through our office. And then his apartment was next door. And yeah, it was like a thing where the only concept was we're going to shoot during San Gennaro. It was a absolute, complete, total chaos and craziness and fun.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a fan of those Abel Ferrara docs. Just kind of feel really like, even at times they have their lulls, but I feel like they're really indebted to just specificity of time and place, and like paint a really good portrait. Especially what's the one, Piazza Vittorio? I really love that one. That one's awesome. Yeah, and just like, that's, I don't cool. know, would you ever want to do like documentary stuff like that, nonfiction, or are you just mainly trying to stay with what you've been doing so far?
Yeah, I just want to keep doing this, but you know, these most features is like dipping a toe.
Yeah, exactly.
I think we're gonna stick to making narratives, but yeah, I love Piazza Vittorio. It's like you feel like you know this neighborhood without having been there. But the thing I like also about them is these are movies that are, especially that one too, where it's like we have a location, and that we're gonna make everything sort of from that. You know, so Chelsea Hotel, there wasn't like a thesis going into it. There wasn't a plan. There wasn't whatever. So same with Mobisheet, Piazza Vittorio. I love, and even like, you know, Light Sleeper, Joe's World, these things, these movies that use real locations, and you make that sort of a starting point for a lot of stuff as opposed to an end point. But yeah.
Changing gears entirely, there's a part in Job's World where after Theo's big movie star character dies and everyone's reacting to it in the bar, a dude pulls out a giant Box Mod vape and says, "I haven't vaped in like 3 weeks." And this line was very funny to me. But in a nutshell, this is the stupidest question ever, but how have you seen vape culture change since you shot this?
Yeah, so it's a weird thing. It's like, I remember, I would start with Bluetooth, where this was something that looked so unbelievably stupid. Yeah. Like seeing people with those headsets on, I was like, this is never going to catch on in a million years. People have too much dignity that they would never walk around looking like this. And then it caught on. And then vaping comes out. I'm like, this is so dumb. This is never going to catch on. This is like, no person with self-respect would do this. And then everyone becomes addicted. Everyone does it. Yeah, it assimilated. It's like, you know, like face tattoos, you're shocked by it, you see it, now it's normal. And then e-scooters was the other one where it's like, you see this thing, like, this is too, like a Segway or a solo wheel. This is too ridiculous. This is never going to catch on. I see it 100 times a day. So, you know, these things have all assimilated. But I think the final war is the Apple Vision Pro, you know, because that's, if you look at the 90s VR headsets, they're not that different than how they look now. So it's been 30 years they've been trying to force this dumb look onto the people. And we've been pushing back hard. I don't think people like the look. I don't think people want to do it. And I think this is kind of like a line in the sand where if we all catch on to do this, I think they can push anything on us. But if we fight back, you know, there might be some shred for humanity left here.
I haven't seen a single person wearing the VR headset yet. Every video I see on Twitter is like a guy trying to go viral on the subway wearing one or something, you know.
Well, the last thing about vapes, really quick.
Yeah, I'll talk all night about vaping.
One of the big changes is obviously they banned a lot of them, you know?
The flavors.
And I really don't support that. And I'm not a smoker. Mm-hmm. Because there were these fruity flavors. It was like mango, papaya, or like electric, you know, guava, whatever. And I really think that like marketing culture is so infantilized right now, you know, where the average video game buyer is in their late 30s, you know, it's like we're all obsessed with Marvel, you know, things that historically have been for kids. And I think that marketing things as childish is really marketing things to adults. You know, I think kids want things that are for grownups. You know, like why the fuck would a kid, like a high school kid, want to buy something with, for four-year-olds? You know, like they want to do stuff that adults do. So, like, I totally reject the idea that like cartoon characters is somehow marketing to kids. I think it's actually marketing to adults. And I think if you got to market to kids, it's like the more the iPhone aesthetic or some shit, or I don't even know what the fuck, or those Predator, those computers that are like black with like, look like some like military fucking shit, like lights everywhere. I don't know. Hard to say, but I think marketing, they should have let those flavors stay.
And now it's
the craziest thing is the biggest change to the landscape in New York. There's the shacks that happened during COVID, but now this gray market weed is like every single block. Literally every single block, there's like two of these fucking stores with these murals of these fried Rick and Morty's and Smurfs with like Rasta hats and like Fred Flintstone on a whatever the fuck motorcycle. Yeah, just like dumb shit. And now it's that has become a de-gentrification look, and it's interesting to see it, and no one's cracking down on that. No one gives a fuck, and it's interesting.
And a lot of them are selling just like, in terms of vapes, just like fake carts too, which is the funniest part. It's just like, yeah, it's legal, you could come get it, but it's like Delta 8, you know, and it's just like maybe gonna give you cancer because it's not actually tested by the FDA, but for all intents and purposes gets you pretty faded, you know. Like I remember when I was in high school, everyone was smoking that quote-unquote spice to beat like drug tests, which is like, I mean, that's Dune shit right there. But it's just so ridiculous how quickly all that shit got assimilated. But changing gears again, I read in an interview a while back, you said like most of the stuff you watch is going to be on 35 at a theater. And so are you still like that? Is most of the movies you watch just like repertory screenings in the city?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I don't go as much as I used to go all the time. Nonstop. I probably see like one movie in the theater a week or so. Nice. Yeah.
I'm mainly just jealous because I've never been able to just only watch rep cinema. Yeah, it's a question.
It's a crazy thing where it's like, you know, I've always felt appreciative of it. It's like, this is a miracle. This is unbelievable that we can do this. And then, you know, the movie pass era was that's like the golden age. Mm-hmm. You didn't even have to pay to go. You pay $20 a month. And then COVID happened. And like, I was like, this is it, guys. We're fucking throwing the towel. Mm-hmm. Like, this shit's not reopening. No one's going to give us this shit back. And it's like fucking great now. It really, it's like, feels like it's just as good as it's ever been. And like, especially with like, the Roxy has been so fucking cool. They've shown, you know, so much stuff I love, so much of my stuff. They showed, you know, Light Sleeper there. They showed up. They've been letting us do a lot of what we want. I saw you guys did an episode on Black and White.
Yeah.
I did a series last summer. My dream series. It was called Wanksters on 35. And we did I'm Still Here, Black and White, and White Boys.
Damn. That is 35. Crazy.
And that was like, I've been wanting to do this series for like a million years. I'm like, no one's ever going to let me do this. This is like pipe dream. And we did it like at the Roxy. So it really feels, there's a lot of good venues right now. And it's sort of a new way of releasing movies also. Like even like with Project Space, I didn't submit it to festivals. You know, I was like, I'm not going through this shit. I'm like, we got distributed, we got Mubi on board, we got Circle Collective, which is part of Utopia, and then played at the Roxy, did that, you know, still got the Vinegar Syndrome Blu-ray. So, you know, there's ways, you know, things are changing, and we can get a theatrical life and digital life in ways that are that you weren't able to in the past. And these theaters have really been a big asset to that.
How did you link up with Theo Bukalis?
I had heard the name before. But I guess I had seen him in Soft in the Head. And I remember he was good in it, but I didn't know him. And so we wrote this character. So, you know, he's supposed to be the most beloved, talented actor on earth, which is really an impossible role to play, because it's like, how do you do it? You either have to be the greatest actor of all time,
or
be really hammy, you know, where's the thing? And I think he did a great job of finding in between. But so originally I was going to do this French guy, and it was going to make a Depardieu type character. And then I was going to do it for a second, and I was going to be like I'm still here kind of thing, whereas like some actor who's like going through a rebrand, where he becomes like a fat ass psycho, you know. And then my friend Adam Ginsberg was like, oh, you should talk to this guy Theo, he's really good. And I emailed him, and he wrote me back this like really, really long, detailed, weird email. And I was like, whoa, this is pretty interesting. And we did an audition with him, and it was just one of those things where it was like on site, This guy's off the fucking hook. Absolutely, this is the only choice. And he really is like just one of those guys, and you see him in person, hang out with him, he really is just always on. He's really funny. He's really knowledgeable. And he's the man.
Yeah, no, Theo's the man.
I couldn't believe the first sort of, he's like friends with like all these people you would never expect. Like, he knows Whit Stillman somehow. And like, that was like, he gave us like some weird shout out when Jobs came out, just because he's friends with like Theo. And he's really funny. And he adds a lot to the dialogue. It's mostly written, but when he embellishes, it just cracks me up. He's really funny. What the fuck?
I wish I knew Whit Stillman was homies with Theo. I would have asked him about it. Like, I had Whit Stillman on in my apartment, and I didn't ask him about Theo. That's insane.
This is rare info.
No, I mean, it makes sense. Like, absolutely. I worked with him a year and a half ago now on a movie that still hasn't come out. Yeah. And I didn't fucking make the movie or anything, you know. But like, he is just the man. Like, hanging out with him late, like an overnight 20 degree in Boston or in Worcester, Mass, like smoking with a giant teddy bear who tells you that you've made him feel so warm inside, is just it's this thing that I'll never get on another movie set, you know?
Completely. No, all my most, like, the scenes with him and Jason, or the scene in his apartment, that was all one night we shot that. And it was like overnight. Just by the end, everyone was just delirious and sort of added to his embellishments and improvisations and stuff. And it really, we were just dying. It was the hardest I've laughed in like a long time. It really is just funny. And he really, we're all just kind of cracking up, having a great time.
My buddy Ethan told me to ask you about USA Up All Night, which I then looked into and watched a bunch of Gilbert Gottfried interstitials. Is this a formative thing for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was something I really liked when I was in like junior high, probably, you know. Through, it was like a show that was just on, really, it came out after Night Flight. That was like the 80s nice thing on USA, where they would show video art and weird cult movies and things. But USA Up All Night, it's like a late 80s through 90s thing where Gilbert Gottfried were on a share, and they would just show like B movies, like kind of trauma type stuff, like Sorority Babes and the Slime Ball Bullerama type stuff. And they'd have these little skits with Gilbert Gottfried. But yeah, it was just like a funny B movie, zero star type thing that I really fucked with at the time. And I was joking. I was saying when I was really young, I would just read the TV guide and just watch all the movies that had zero stars. You know, those are the only ones I wanted to see. And I was like, maybe someday I can make a movie that no one likes and get stars. And we knocked it out of the park with Happy Life. We got D-minus in the fucking Onion or whatever. So got that out of the system.
Oh, fucking AV Club. Okay. Yeah.
Whatever.
But The Onion. AV Club now carries no weight. That's like, you won the battle, you know, at this point. Time will tell.
It was so annoying because it was like, I mean, that was annoying, that's funny, but it was annoying that it was like the Onion, it's like a joke newspaper.
Yeah.
And then you get the film reviews and they're like, earnest, serious, telling me about the new Daniel Day-Lewis movie or whatever. Yeah. I'm like,
you got Nathan Raven writing about why a Steven Seagal movie is so good, so bad it's good, you know?
Yeah, and it's like, why don't you just do some funny fucking reviews of movies? And it really was this long stretch of a sort of humorless, like, way of looking at film culture, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the internet sort of trolling stuff and podcasts and stuff really was something that just naturally had to happen because, you know, there was this self-serious thing that really was dominant, you know, and there really was a giant room for people to talk about these things in a way that's, you know, honest, but also funny, you know, and it really was like, that really drove me crazy, like how just serious everything was. And there was no way to read other than joking with your friends to get a take on, you know, the specific culture that was really top down, kind of controlled by these sort of institutions that I like. But it's just nice to have more, you know, then it is at the cost now of losing all good film criticism, which is like over the pendulum over swing, you know. Yeah. So now it's like I can only read half baked dumb shit, you know, and it's almost impossible to find long form articulate good stuff, but who knows.
Well, there's a balance. Have fun, but watch the movie. that's my main critique for most film critics. Watch the movie a little closer, please. Yeah. Anyway, Mike, what's next? You have something in development?
I'm almost done writing something. So yeah. I don't know. It's taking longer than usual. But yeah, I'm trying to get something off the ground pretty soon. I heard this story about David Lynch recently that apparently he just like spends most of his time, you know, he has this persona that he's, you know, in the studio at 9 a.m. like sawing some fucking desk like in half or whatever, and making a lamp or something, you know, learning how to build a light bulb. And like what I heard is unconfirmed that he just is in bed all the fucking time not doing shit, just being lazy, having a nice time, joking around. And then he like goes through periods of extreme bursts where it's like gets out of bed one day and it's like, all right, now it's time to fucking do this shit, you know. So I'm in the hanging out in bed part of the creative process, I think, recently. I'm trying to talk to my parents. I'm like, what are you up to? I'm just like building up.
Building up.
Hey, you David Lynch stays in bed. Like, why can't, like,
Have you been watching anything in particular that's good lately?
I was at my friend Steven's house the other night. We were watching a bunch of Benihana videos. Nice. That was pretty sick. It's like chopping up
sick tricks.
Chopping up some onions and throwing some rice on the hibachi. And it was like very high energy. There was like a percussive quality. We threw on some David Guetta music at one point, and we're getting pretty turned up just watching these videos. And
you know, I saw on Instagram you posting some Benihana stuff, including their store. And so the Benihana branded slippers are like $350, which I think is like a real commitment, because at that point, you're buying a hibachi table for your house, right? Like, if you're buying the $350 Benihana slippers.
Not for everyone, man. It's all for like for some rare ballers. Like, want to go hard. And I got the like chef hat. I just got this. I didn't go all out. I didn't get everything. I got a few.
You got a few?
A few nice treats. Yeah, and then my friend Hunter, who shot the I'll Cut Your Dick Off video, and he's in Project Space 13. Mm-hmm. He sent me some video the last night or two nights ago, where he somehow on his stove, he got some, like, I don't know what it was, like a pan or something. He was making his own hibachi and like chopped up some meat and stuff. So.
Well, hibachi only diet.
We're trying to learn how to how to do like Benihana style. Okay. So that was the last
enough people buy that Blu-ray, you know, Mike's gonna be able to afford a Teppan table in his fucking apartment. Stink up the building. That's why you gotta do it. Don't do it for cinema. Do it for the sake of Benihana at home, you know.
For onion pyramids.
No, when we shot that thing with Christopher Walken is on the addiction bonus feature, he was just he has this little like man cave house outside of their main house where he just had some like kitchen where he was just like chefing up little delicacies all day seemed to be his like big activity. Watching Charlie Rose, or he was complaining that Charlie Rose is canceled, but yeah, it's like this is the lifestyle we're going for. We just want to be we just want to be making exotic treats on the stove. Do a little writing.
That was me in fucking college, dude. Like fucking it, not exotic, just pounding McDonald's and watching like the Paul Thomas Anderson, Charlie Rose videos, like those interviews. Very pathetic 19-year-old image, but hey, it made me the man I am now.
I didn't make it. There's a Charlie Rose Schrader talking about Light Sleeper. I only watched part of it.
Yeah,
but pretty good.
Yeah, check. I'm sure he asked some very probing questions. Anyway, I think that's gonna do it for this episode of Extended Clip. Mike, thank you so much for coming on the pod. Of course, we are plugging Job's World on Blu-ray now, but anything else you want to tell the people before we get out of here?
Not at all. Thanks for doing this. This was really fun to do this and to like rewatch that. So
yeah, of course, you're welcome to come back anytime, talk about some more movies. You can subscribe to us on Patreon. Link will be in the description. $5 a month gets you an extra episode every single week. $15 a month, you get to produce an episode as well, meaning you get to program everything that we are going to talk about. You don't write the script, you know, but you know
what I mean.
Yeah, you choose the movie. It's simple as that. I like bringing it up in bigger terms, kind
of,
you know.
Of course, yeah.
But anyway, on the next episode, we are going to be talking about Yearning. By Mikio Naruse. I think that's the next episode. See ya then.